So our Dharma talk this morning will be given by Boundless Way Senior Dharma Teacher Alan Richardson.
When I learned about a week or so ago that I might be giving a talk to you today, and that we would be talking about the second section of Shunryu Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I took my ancient copy and I let it fall open in the middle to see what would come up. And here's what came up. This is a Dharma talk he gave called Limiting Your Activity, or that's the title that it was given. And he's talking about the fact that our purpose in that our practice in Zen is without particular purpose or goal. We do not have a goal-directed purpose. And then he goes on to say this. I'm going to read you two paragraphs. You may think that if there's no purpose or no goal in our practice, we will not know what to do. But there is a way. The way to practice without having any goal is to limit your activity or to be concentrated on what you are doing in this moment. Instead of having some particular object in mind, you should limit your activity. When your mind is wandering about elsewhere, you have no chance to express yourself. But if you limit your activity to what you can do just now, in this moment, then you can express fully your true nature, which is the universal Buddha nature. This is our way. When we practice Zazen, we limit our activity to the smallest extent. Just keeping the right posture and being concentrated on sitting is how we express the universal nature. Then we become Buddha, and we express Buddha nature. So instead of having some object of worship, we just concentrate on the activity which we do in each moment. When you bow, you should just bow. When you sit, you should just sit. When you eat, you should just eat. If you can do this, the universal nature is there. In Japanese, we call it Ichigyo Zamai, or one-act samadhi. Samai, or samadhi, is concentration. Ichigyo is one practice. So one of the really interesting things about working with this text at this sesshin is to hear these fragments of Dharma talks that are very different from the Dharma talks that we hear at Boundless Way Zen and that we sometimes give at Boundless Way Zen. For example, we don't often talk about samadhi in Boundless Way Zen. And there's a good reason for that, because we don't want a zendo full of people thinking that maybe they should be experiencing some special state of mind. This is not what Shunryu Suzuki Roshi means by samadhi, but so easy to get it wrong and be caught up in the delusions about our practice. And we also don't tend to say very much about concentration and limiting our activity and practicing Zazen in this rather special way. And there are good reasons not to do this also. It's very easy to fetishize the posture and the breath and a certain way of practicing. There's a danger there that we try to avoid. We're much more likely when we talk about Zazen practice to talk about our failures and our frustrations. This is our compassionate way in Boundless Way Zen. It's also possible to fall into the error of fetishizing Zazen itself and making that the key to our practice lives rather than just one part of all the ways we have of manifesting our Buddha nature, of living Buddha's life. So I can illustrate these dangers in my own case. And to do that, I would start by telling you a little bit more about my relationship to this book. I read this book first when I was 17 years old, about a year and a half after it came out. I was very excited to have this book because at that time, and this was 1972, there were almost no good Dharma books that you could find anywhere in English. And that's very hard for us to remember today or imagine if we weren't there, because now there's so many, you can hardly read them all. But back then, there were only a handful. And so this book was really precious to me and to others. You get an idea of how long ago this was if I tell you the price on my copy of the book, which is $2.50. You think I got a good deal? Still a bargain, by the way, at $15 on the hallway table. So I read this book, and not only was it one of the very few good Dharma books you could get, but it was the only book I knew about that could give you a real and rich idea of what daily Zen practice would be like. Not just wonderful and intriguing and excitingly paradoxical ideas about Zen like you could find in Alan Watts, but actually how just hands-on, day-by-day sense of how you could practice Zen. And this had a huge effect on me. And there was also for me an excitement about this book, because even though I knew from the preface and the introduction that Shunyu Suzuki had sadly recently died, much too young, even though I knew that, I also knew that there was a thriving practice center that he had established and nurtured for years that was right there. It was right down the road in San Francisco. And when I say down the road, I mean that if you lived in Seattle in those days, San Francisco was just down I-5, and all you had to do was walk to a freeway entrance and put out your thumb. And in about 12 hours, you would be there. And I, at the tender age of 17, I'd already done that a couple of times. It's just what we did. It tells you something about those days. And so I did it one more time. I put out my thumb and hitchhiked to San Francisco, I thought for the last time, because I wanted to be part of this. I wanted to practice in the way that I had read about in Shunyu Suzuki's really inspiring series of Dharma talks. So, as I said, I now become an illustration of the dangers of fetishizing Zazen. And let me say that on the one hand, I can't say with any certainty that this is an accurate reflection of the teachings at the San Francisco Zen Center at this time. But let me also say that I came by this honestly. And there was almost no verbal instruction at the San Francisco Zen Center when I was there. I was there for about a year, most of a year. There was no verbal instruction except for Richard Baker Roshi's Dharma talks on Saturdays. He was Shunyu Suzuki's ill-starred Dharma heir. And I liked those talks, but other than those Saturday talks, there was almost no verbal instruction, and you just came and you sat. And I had, in 10 or 11 months, I had 3 interviews. The first one was with the head monk, Dan Welch, and this was an interview that I had to see if I could attend the summer sesshin at Tassajara Monastery. And this was my heart's desire. This is why I was there. And it was very encouraging because he saw me in the Zendo all the time. And then I had a second interview that was an awkward interview and to me rather puzzling with Richard Baker himself. And then I had another interview, very short, with Dan Welch, with the head monk, where I learned that I definitely would not be attending summer sesshin at Dasahara. Yes, we can laugh now. But at the time, I remember walking home from the Zendo in tears. Hot, spurting, adolescent tears. Because I wanted to be a Zen monk. That's all I wanted to do. And of course, with every tear, I realized that Richard Baker was right. I wouldn't be crying. I wouldn't be weeping like this if I were ready to attend summer sesshin at Tassajara. Damn him. So he was right, and I eventually decided that, and I think this is what he was trying to tell me. I actually think it was very compassionate of him, especially when I read what would have happened to me if I'd stayed at the San Francisco Zen Center. I decided that I really ought to go to college and do some of the other things that 18-year-old Americans did at the time. And so I did that. So that was the sum of my interviews, but there was lots of nonverbal teaching. And I thought if I told you a little bit about that, it might give you some more insight into Shunryu Suzuki's teaching. So you would go into the Zendo, and there were four Zazen periods a day at 5 and at 5:50, and then at 6:30 in the evening, I think, and then there was the late evening Zazen period, which was my favorite, and that was at, I think, 10, because who needed to sleep? And every period was 40 minutes long, so you would go in and you would find an open place in the Zendo, and it would be on a raised platform on a tatami mat with a zabuton and zafu, and you would bow and sit and face the wall, and there were beautiful white partitions running up and down the Zendo. And so you would face the white wall and you would sit. And then there would be a priest or a lay practice leader who would be kind of patrolling the Zendo as we sat. And often this person would come up behind you, you couldn't see them of course, and start adjusting your posture. So maybe pushing the small of your back in, or maybe pushing down your shoulders and you realize how tight they've been, or maybe tucking your chin in, or even reaching around to adjust your mudra. So it was very intimate in a kind of severely impersonal way. And there was a lot of this teaching. And then in addition, there was another form of nonverbal teaching. And there would be another priest who was patrolling the Zendo with a kyosatsu. And every once in a while, you would feel this rubbing, slat of wood rubbing on your shoulder back and forth. Because you did not ask for the kyosaku, thus kyosaku asked for you. And you always said yes. So you would assume the position and lean over one way, whack, whack, and lean over the other way, whack, whack, and bow. And then, you know, it would be up to you to figure out what you've been doing wrong this time. And so you got to have some initiative in correcting your own posture. So lots and lots of immediate hands-on instruction in this posture. And by the way, there was only one acceptable posture. And I can't demonstrate it for you right now because my knee won't let me. And Jason is kindly demonstrating it for us, the half lotus, or at worst quarter lotus, that was allowed. But Jason, by the way, I can imagine a lot of adjustments that we could do. But we won't. We don't teach that way at Boundless Ways. No, Jason is very nicely demonstrating it for us. That was the only posture you could take. There was one person in the Zendo who could do Seiza position on a bench who was older, and this was known as a special dispensation, and don't even ask. So a kind of rigidity about this that again, I'm not sure that this was in keeping exactly with what Suzuki Roshi had meant to hand down, but this is how his legacy was being maintained when I was there. Now, maybe all this sounds kind of grim. And maybe in some ways it was, and I certainly would not teach new students in this way. And I hasten to say that they don't teach that way at San Francisco Zen Center anymore. The periods aren't 40 minutes anymore. And I asked the Eno to lead us in reading Reb Anderson's guidance in Shikantaza, because that's much more representative of what the San Francisco Zen Center has become. Reb Anderson was one of the other students of Suzuki Roshi, who took over as abbot with Blanche Hartman after Richard Baker had to leave. And it's clear that they arrived at a much more free and open interpretation of Suzuki Roshi's legacy. And so Reb Anderson tells us, you know, you could joyfully sit concentrating on the posture and the breath. But Zazen is not limited to this activity. But when I was there, Zazen was pretty much limited to that activity. And maybe it sounds like I feel cheated or I am complaining about this. So let me make this clear, that I'm so grateful for that year of teaching, physical teaching at the San Francisco Zen Center. And even though I would not teach anyone that way myself, at that very different time, and when there was almost no place in America where you could study Zen, and teachers were trying to really establish a genuine Zen spirit in America, and at that very idealistic age that I was at, I think it was really good for me in many ways to do all that sitting and to do it in this aspirational way. And that's really what came to me when I reread this Dharma Talk by Suzuki Roshi, how aspirational that is. Let me just read the most relevant sentence or two again. We don't sit with a goal, but we sit with an intention. So when we practice Zazen, we limit our activity to the smallest extent. Just keeping the right posture and being concentrated on sitting is how we express the universal nature. So sitting with this intention, day after day, period after period, I think it was a wonderful practice for me at that age and at that time of my life. And after I did leave San Francisco Zen Center, I had a year before I did go off to college to let things sink in. And a couple months after I left, I had an experience that I won't try to describe to you. But I'll just say two things about it. And one is that in the aftermath of this experience that I had, I knew the way that I know that I have two hands, that my relationship to the self and to the universe had changed in this cataclysmic and irreversible way as a result of that practice that I did. So that was one thing that I knew. I just knew this. And I just knew another thing, which is that I would eventually come back. Not to necessarily to the San Francisco Zen Center, but I would come back to Zen practice. I didn't know when or how long it would take. I didn't know it would take 30 years. But the nice thing was I knew that I would, and so I didn't worry about it for those 30 years, which was really good. And here I am, and here we all are. So in the spirit of aspirational descriptions of Shikantaza and Zazen, I want to read you one other description, not by Suzuki Roshi, but by Matsuo Basho, the great haiku poet who lived in 12th century Japan, and who is also, as Suzuki Roshi, is one of our collateral ancestors. And there's a book I recommend to you all by our direct ancestor, Robert Aitken Roshi, called The Zen Way, which makes which gives a very nice presentation of Basho's teachings as Zen teachings that we can all profit from. So this is from another of my enthusiasms at age 17 that is still with me. And this is from Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North, also translated as The Narrow Road to the Interior. So this is the road we're on together at this retreat. And this is his haibun, a mix of haiku and prose, talking about his travels to the north of Japan, which then was quite an adventurous thing to do, to travel up there. And this is when he's come to Ushisato Mountain, and there's a monastery on top of this mountain. So let me read you just a couple of sentences from Basho. This temple is Tendai sect, like the one in Edo on Toei Hill. Both follow the doctrine of Shikantaza, deep sitting concentration and insight, a way of enlightenment as transparent as moonlight. It's like infinitely increasing, spreading from hermitage to mountaintop and back, reverence and compassion shining in everything it touches. Its blessing flows down from these mountains, enriching all our lives. Now, I would not want this to be my only statement about Shikantaza and to try to hold myself to that beautiful expression every time I sat down. And yet, I also feel so fortunate to have that as one way of thinking about Shikantaza. And again, a very aspirational way, just as I feel quite grateful to have these aspirational description of Zazen from Shunya Suzuki Roshi, who was not my teacher, but whose teaching permeated the San Francisco Zen Center when I was there so many years ago.
So I invite you to sit comfortably. We'll begin our Dharma dialogue in a moment. Thank you, Alan. Just want to give a special welcome to Josh Bartok, one of the guiding teachers of Boundless Way, with Melissa and myself, James Ford and James Cordova. Josh is the abbot at Greater Boston Zen Center and is going to be in residence for a few days, so we're always delighted to have him come play with us. So welcome, Josh. So, observations, questions, reflections?
Just share a little story about Alan. Long ago, I don't know, maybe in like 2003 or 4 or something, at James Ford Sangha in Newton, one of the practices that we did there was, during one of the periods, people who wanted to have essentially kind of a free-form Dharma dialogue would go into the kitchen of the church, and we would just have a little bit of question and answer. I always went, because any excuse to not sit Zazen is something else. That's one I would know. I would often be in a position of responding to questions. And Alan would also often come. And at one point I said to Alan, yeah, you're one of the senior members of the Sangha. And Alan practically jumped out of his skin. He was quite startled that would be that I would say such a thing. But I even then kind of not even knowing so much of that story, like I could see the impact of this kind of physical embodied practice of Zen, and so I just felt like I wanted to share that with all you. So don't imagine this doesn't do anything. Even if you go away for 30 years and imagine that you are not currently practicing Zen. And I think Alan's story is also a really beautiful illustration of the way in which the point of no return on this path is quite early.
Yeah, Lynn.
Your story, personal story, echoes mine in many ways, including the timing, although I'm a little older than you are. And I was on the East Coast rather than the West Coast and had an introduction at a Zendo, the New York Zen Center, and the First Zen Institute in New York City. And I remember being hit by the Kurosaku many times. And I share your feelings about that early training, because when I come here, people say, you can sit quietly, or you sit still. And I learned to sit still. it was torture sometimes when your nose was running and you did, you know, but or it really hurt. But it was good training. But I really do appreciate Boundless Way's change to all of the other ways of teaching. Because I don't think I would continue with Zen if it was so focused on samadhi with a specific definition. Enlightenment, certain experiences, because I've not had them in the way that they're described in some of the books. So thank you all for creating this form of Zen practice, which is disciplined and serious and no nonsense, but the fact that we talk in the Zendo is and laugh. You know, I don't think I heard one laugh in the years, the 5 years I studied Zen in my early days. So thank you all.
Lynn, wonderful to hear that reflection back, because we have worked hard on the adaptation. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Right?
No, and you haven't. I mean, you wear the uniforms.
We do wear the uniforms.
Sit on the cushion.
And I think that my hope is that we have a spirit that continues, because many of us were trained, actually four of the current five guiding teachers were trained by people who were very, very disciplined and expected the kind of, got the kind of training you got, that Alan got. But one thing I wanted to really call out in what you said, actually two things, if I can remember them. One is that I didn't have enlightenment, and then you said, like the way they were describing. Because I think Alan said it really beautifully when we talked about samadhi. Of course there's samadhi. Of course there's, my preferred word is awakening. But it doesn't look like some idea that we have from reading or from hearing other people talk. And this is, I think, the most precious and hopefully continually clarifying thing in our way, that really we say everyone is an awakened being, everyone is a Buddha. And when we realize that, we're affirmed by a teacher, but we're not like told, yep, great, you're done. Now you can go, right? But we're saying this is part of it, and we don't, and Alan used this word, and we've used this word a few times in discussing this book, we don't fetishize it. Right, it's one of the many experiences that arises. It's extremely common, not so special, and it's really part of the way. And the other thing I wanted to let you know is that we do use the Kiyosaku, but we only use it in a very specific way. We don't use it at the coming and going sesshin. We don't use it at our daily sittings, or I don't at our old days. You don't use it at the Zen Center. We use it in a very specific way throughout the day, and use the translation of kisaku in Japanese means encouragement mm-hmm. to stick. Mm-hmm. So we use it to encourage people when they feel they need to be encouraged. So people put up their hands in gassho and ask for it. And that's a really important shift so that you're not just this helpless being at the mercy of some person with a stick, right? But instead you can feel, I need a little something. And some people never ask for it, which is fine. And there was a period in our time when if you put your hands up in gassho, you would get the stick. But if you put your hands in what we call a tea bow and lean forward, you would get a massage. Isn't that nice? And it was akin to, you know, these are adaptations to what Alan was talking about the posture, right? This is a way to, you know, to have. And David and I, when we first started the group here in Worcester, we didn't use the stick at all. We just did massages and posture help, we called it. But people would have to ask for it. And I think that efficacy, you know, to turn that around is so important.
I don't know if I can add one thing, but the other aspect of that early Zen training, which I think is also taken into consideration here, is I had gotten that message that there is other forms of awakening than the stories that are described in some of the books. It always struck me as extremely paradoxical that teachers who have had those great experiences could then do some very damaging things to their students. And so I think I sense that your approach to teaching and broadening that understanding of awakening has also a way to balance that, you know, you're here, you're going to fall off the edge. And even if you fall off the edge as a teacher, it's okay because you still are an enlightened person. You are working to deal with all of that. And it's very hard, and it's true in churches and everywhere else.
Yes, it is.
But thank you for that, too.
What?
Yeah, and I think part of what we're talking about here is the awakening of Zen in the West. Mm-hmm. You know, there really is generational learning, and those first teachers, mostly from Japan and some from Korea, were, you know, awakening, and there is absolute truth in what they're saying. But the image that most of us heard is that it's this binary thing, either you are or you aren't, and if you are, all of your problems are over, right? And that's what I want, right?
Yes.
Now, Alan, I was so moved when you talked about after you left the monastery in that next year of some moment realizing that a shift has happened, a shift had happened, that there is a shift that happens. And it's not like anything we can talk about. And in some way, it's the most precious thing in the world when we wake up. But it doesn't become a thing that we can put in our pocket. And when we do that, and the part of the teaching of the early teachers in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s was that...
Up till the present moment.
Was that awakening is lovely, but it's not... It doesn't save you from yourself. And so these... You know, so we read this wonderful book by Suzuki Roshi, and we think, well, there's someone who had it. And his Dharma heir, Richard Baker... turns out got you know, really terrible ethical violations and really misusing power and relationships, and so we aren't saved when we're awakened. We still need each other, and part of our model here that really is developing is this teacher sangha, collegial teachers, so not just one, you know, wonderful, charismatic teacher who's the authority, but we have a community of teachers to help us. A dangerous occupation, yeah, in churches everywhere. So really, we're part of the development of this, and some of us have seen the different stages. So, yeah.
And just to add to that, I laughed because I thought, five wonderful charismatic teachers. And we're exactly alike, too. The thing about really allowing people to be fully human is also part of our way. That's so important. Mm-hmm. And so we realize that awakening needs to be balanced by precepts. And there was a lot of not ignoring of the precepts, because precepts were taken in name, for sure, but not, as you say, the exception, right? That if I'm awake, I can do anything I want because it's my awakened nature manifesting itself. When one of our students starts saying that, we like yank them, right? Because it is a danger. In this very disciplined practice of being present with everything that arises, we can get carried away. And we, the four of the five guiding teachers, have seen that sort of behavior firsthand. And so we were very, very eager to not have that happen with us. And yet, we're human, so the fact that we're collegial is very important. We help each other so that we can help the Sangha. And then the Sangha can help us. Yeah, it's very mutual.
Thanks.
Thank you, Alan. And just to continue on this conversation, I was also a recipient of that kind of treatment in a former spiritual group. And so another thing that I really appreciate about here is that there's an ethics committee. And the holding of the structure, the integrity, and the spirit of it is so, I feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I can just respond briefly to that. I was, I had the privilege of being on the leadership council when we instituted the ethics policy. And one thing that was very clear is the advantages of having a group where there is not a single charismatic leader, and where there is, there's often resistance to the ethics policy because that leader knows who it's about.
And we all thought it was about the other teachers. Oh, this must be for the other teachers.
That's
so
how it works.
Fine.
Everyone just pointed. So all these things hang together, and I don't want to get too much into the San Francisco of those days, but the SFCC at that time was extremely hierarchical. You can read a book about it. There is a book about it, and it was so hierarchical. And this was partly, I think, a defensiveness about trying to carry on the legacy of Suzuki Roshi, who it was impossible to fill those shoes. He was idolized by. I feel like I knew him because everyone was still talking about Suzuki Roshi all the time. I heard so many stories. So many people missed him. People were still crying. Would start crying a year and a half later, and impossible to fill those shoes. And so the two ways to go with that, and one would be, so let's spread authority out and hear all these people like Reb Anderson and Blanche Hartman that could help. The other way would be, let's just really, limit authority to even more than it was before and really be the Roshi, and not the way to go. Mm-hmm. And so another reason for us to be grateful for the way that authority here continues to spread. We're not even sure how many guiding teachers we have anymore.
I'm sure we have five. Pretty soon we're going to have six.
See what I mean?
And then
seven.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we're going to take a break.
Thank you so much for your talk. Quite a life you've had. And I really appreciated your pointing to the nonverbal teaching. Mm-hmm. And so what came up for me, a couple things. One was, in the absence of verbal instructions, this is where we go. Mm-hmm. Or one of the places we go is like, well, how are they doing it? How does it look? Mm-hmm. What are they doing? I remember actually being in Japan decades ago, and we went into a little restaurant off the beaten track. No one there spoke English, and they brought the food, and there was this very tall stack of this green stuff, and we didn't know what it was, and the, no instructions, mm-hmm. right? And so I was watching people around the room, what were they doing with this, right? So, of course, you probably already guessed it's wasabi, so, mm-hmm. But this was my way, anyway, without any instruction. I watched very closely, what to do. And I also, what came up for me is how we're always giving nonverbal mm-hmm. instructions in some, and whether we know it or not. Mm-hmm. And that realization actually has been a very important teaching for me in this practice of in all kinds of ways. So I really deeply appreciate you talking about that.
And I love what you're saying, and of course how inadequate all the verbal instructions are. So let me tell you how to meditate. What? Let me tell you how to work on mu. Well, what? That no one can actually tell you how to do this. So I love you pointing to we're pointing to this life teaching you how to live this life, the practice teaching you how to practice, and all of us teaching each other as we sit in the Zendo, nonverbal instruction. We are all teaching, and this teaching of the heart, I think, underpins all of the words, that they come into that and may be useful for a while, and you think, oh, okay, just be with the sensation, and you get this little hit, and you, some gas gets in the car, and it goes about 30 miles, and then and it stops, and you push on the accelerator, and nothing. And those are the moments of great teaching, when you run out of the great instruction and are thrown back on, what is this? What is happening? But this wonderful mix, I think both so important. But thank you for mentioning. It is mostly nonverbal here, too. Yeah, Leslie, Joanne.
It's interesting getting to hear everyone's stories, people who told their stories about their first experience with Zen, and I had this strange just stuff that popped up in my head with being in my family and sitting at the dinner table, weren't able to talk at the dinner table ever. And that was post-divorce, post-second marriage. And yet there was this, supposed reverence you were supposed to have for it. And you couldn't behave in certain ways at the dinner table. If you did, you'd get physically hurt. And there's this strange coupling with what was lacking, the compassion that was lacking there, and you learn to tolerate certain things, and so you're drawn maybe into situations based on your tolerance that you don't even know you're tolerating. And so when I came here, I was scared to death, because but I was also at the end of so many things. And to come in here and potentially sense or to sense a potential certain danger of that might have been based on that tolerance that I developed, and then to come in and and someone said to me the other day, you can take refuge in the Buddha too, because it's hard for me to do that. And, you know, it's not an imbalance necessarily to take refuge in the Sangha. It's, this is sanin, right? So the patience, constancy. To constancy.
Yeah.
To just let that, you know, and all the openness that you all have to your own experience so makes possible your collegiality. And it's all... It's all the same, but
yeah. wonderful. Thank you, Joanne. So this, to sense this, and the danger. There is danger here in doing this deep work and opening the heart of boundaries and of other things. But this intention for compassion and this. This taking refuge, so important. Yeah.
And this taking refuge in the Buddha is really taking refuge in your own awakened heart. And because that's what Buddha means. It means the one who's awake and awake to this heartfulness, this presence. And then the Sangha is taking refuge in a whole bunch of awakened hearts together, right, that will hold you, and how important each one of us is to that. That one thing that's beating together, breathing together. Thank you for naming it.
So let's take a few more breaths, these beating hearts.